I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.
Want to talk about making shade for your garden? Why do we have so many mulberry trees here? And what are the other options for shade trees?
Okay. So these trees are, they're eras. So you see a particular kind of tree come in. It's an era when they came in, and then they're heavily planted because it's new and exciting. So let's plant a whole lot of mulberry trees. So in the started in the late 50s and mainly in the 60s and 70s, everybody was planting mulberry tree because it was growing really fast, gave you a lot of shade, and then the problems happened. Then it was too much shade, and then the roots are into everything. So what can we do now? So now we're looking at different kinds of trees. So right now, Chinese pistache has been extremely popular. Now it's everywhere. That can be a problem because if you get a disease and you got too many of the one kind, you know, you're going to have problems. So, but Chinese pistache is still a good one, but there's Mount Red Push pistache. It's an Atlas pistache, another extremely drought-tolerant. It was the rootstock for pistachio nuts. It's extremely drought-tolerant, really good. A number of oaks. There are not quite a few oaks, especially the Mexican oaks are more adapted to heat that's coming as climate change takes place. I don't know if that's the correct word. But, yeah, there's some really deep-rooted trees that we should be using.
I guess what we could say is environmental changes.
Environmental changes happen.
Yes, absolutely. 107 and 575-646-2212. Thanks for joining us for the Gardening Confidential on KRWG 90.7 FM and at krwg.org. And for following along on Facebook, Anthony Moreno standing by with to take your Facebook questions and comments. And for everybody who participates today, you'll be entered to win a $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers, making your spring gardening confidential today possible, along with Vaqueta Jewelers. And I know a few of you have been holding for quite some time on the phone. Thank you so much for waiting and for your patience. And Chris, you are next. What is your question?
It's about my soil here in Caballo. I have a wood shop, and I make a lot of sawdust, and wondering if I can... if that'll work good for composting.
Yes.
Or
sawdust is great for composting, but it's got a high carbon ratio there. So you have to add some kind of nitrogen source. So if you have grass clippings to add to that, especially like a fescue grass, but any kind of grass that you have, it's got a richer nitrogen source because the wood shavings, the wood grindings need nitrogen by the bacteria to break them down. All the fungi and bacteria that work in that to break that material down have to have nitrogen. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's
so
great material.
Dig it into the bushes, around the bushes, make a big pile and mix it in with the soil and let it break down.
If you can compost before you do that, because as it decomposes around the bushes, it's going to take nitrogen away from the plant to decompose it. So you want to compensate for that, either fertilize it somehow or compost it before you put it under the bushes.
The soil I have here is mostly desert soil with all the little stones in it, you know, the normal start part, but it's also was a farm a long time ago, and there's areas where it's just really nothing but silt and clay, it seems like, and all the rocks were long ago removed. And
excellent opportunity to use desert-adapted plants in soils like that.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
I said that's an excellent opportunity for where you're at to use desert-adapted plants, ones that don't need a lot of water and don't need a lot of fertilizer or care.
So if I'm going to make a compost pile, like with a tractor or something, what ratio would I mix all that? I've got a lot of sawdust, a bunch. So what is there a typical ratio I would mix that in with the soil for it to sit and...
We'd have to look at that. So why don't you call your county extension agent, and because it'll take more time than just being on the radio here to discuss that. But you can use like manure sources. If there's a dairy nearby, you can use that as well to mix with it. But contact your county agent there in Sierra.
Okay.
All right.
Very informative. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call. And Kevin is next on KRWG. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for having the show. I'm interested if there's anything organic less harmful to the world and us than Roundup. I prefer not to give my money to Monsanto and Bayer as well. But tried burning, and burning is very time intensive, and it only works for the after the gestation, that they come back pretty quick.
So, you know, it's hard. I have to talk to both sides of people that use chemicals, people that want to be organic. So you can, you know, besides burning weeds, you can use a very strong vinegar solution. You got to follow the directions on the label. So it's not vinegar out of the grocery store. You have to look for the one that's 10% or possibly higher.
Okay.
So those are some alternatives there besides weeding and hoeing and all those. Those are only going to mainly go after those annual weeds. So whether they're spring, winter annuals or they're summer annuals. And it's mainly attacking them by burn down or chopping them down. You have very aggressive weeds sometimes that come in like bindweed where the roots are 15 feet deep and wide. And if you break one, you produce more plants. So, you know, Roundup has its place for really aggressive weeds that need to get under control. Not unless you got an army of people to be out there chopping it down all the time.
So. You got an army of people?
No, I'm an army of one.
Yeah. I like to be organic myself, but when I bought my house and the property I'm in, it was filled with all the noxious weeds. And the first year I used Roundup and got rid of them, and I've been 9 years organic.
Okay, so I had heard a lot of stories about the Epsom salts and vinegar and Dawn soap mixture, and then I read an article that said it's total hooey. So I'm going to give the vinegar a shot, and if that doesn't work, I may have to break down and spray something because chasing weeds is not my passion in life.
Is there any other maker of those types of...
So going out, using a pre-emergent is probably one of the safest chemicals to use because the seeds will germinate and it basically kills them right there. So you got to be real careful. Even if you're using organic things, don't be putting salt down. That contaminates your soil. That can destroy your soil and forever. So, you know, you just got to be careful what you're putting on and how you're using it.
Okay, well, I'll give the vinegar a try. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. And next up, a question about slime mold. And Leslie is on the line. Hi. Hi, Leslie. Are you with us? Maria.
Maria, yes.
Hi, Maria. Sorry, just came to a different line there. So, Maria, welcome to the Spring Gardening Confidential. What is your question for Jeff?
I was just calling to, you know, I heard a lady asking about how to keep moisture on the plants. Mm-hmm. What I think, because my house has a lot of sand, it's just a mountain of sand. I put plastic on the bottom.
Okay.
About at least 1 foot of sand. And then I put like cardboard next. And then two feet of the regular dirt with the cedar shaving.
So you're talking about a raised garden in particular?
Yes, because, in order to keep the moisture. Mm-hmm. You know, the humidity on the plant.
Okay, so you have plastic down on the bottom and about a foot of regular sand, and then cardboard, and then your soil on top.
Correct. And then with a cedar shaving.
How long have you been doing that?
And compost.
How long have you been doing that?
For almost 2 years.
Uh-huh. And you've had a lot of success?
Yes.
Jeff, thank you, Maria.
So I would be really concerned with doing that. First off, if you put plastic down on the bottom and you don't have drainage, our water is full of salt and alkalinity, and that's going to build up. So you got to be careful that
I only do the plastic, not, you know, like just around the, let's say that I plant a rose. Okay, what I'm going to do is just put like maybe a square or maybe a foot and a half of plastic underneath. So it will have drainage. You know what I mean?
Around the sides. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And then I put also rock, you know, the regular, you can put like lava rock or any other kind of rock over the plastic.
Yeah, I'll tell you, any kind of soil that you put in there, the more homogeneous that it is, the better it'll drain. If you put layers, layering is... You create impervious layers, and it has built up enough water, so to speak, pressure through gravity as it's moving down to be able to permeate through the next texture. So yeah, it could create more water availability in a sense to the plants are above that, but you're impeding the drainage, and that could present problems in the future. But if it's working for you, you know, that's fine.
Right, if it ain't broke.
Yeah. just watch out for it.
Thank you, Maria. Okay. We appreciate you participating today. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. And poor Leslie was probably screaming into the phone last time around. We thought we had picked up Leslie's line. Leslie, are you with us now?
I'm with you.
Yay. All right.
I'm waiting. I hope you do this every week.
Well, I can't make any promises there, but a slime mold caught my attention, I must be honest.
Well, I'll make it quick. We have some desert, some African tortoises, and we have to water them and feed them hay, and of course they poop. And we've developed a problem with slime mold, which is like a black, it's really gross. We try to dry it out, but it looks like it's already starting to come back.
Is slime mold what you would call it? You know what she's talking about.
Is it on a tree or where is it?
Oh, it's on the ground, and we have some Bermuda grass, and that's where the animals go around on that, and they eat it. But we do have to water it, and I think maybe there was too much water, and we got this, so we tried to dry it out, but it's still there.
Okay, I'd have to actually see that.
Can you?
I'm not.
Maybe you can get a picture of it and follow up with Jeff.
Yeah, that'd be better.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but
the next question.
I actually have to see it. It's going to take more than just a quick answer.
What should Leslie do next in order to follow up with you, Jeff?
You can call our office 525-6649. Of course, area code 575, and our administrative secretary there can give you my email, and you can send me pictures of it to begin with, and I can get back with you.
Okay, Leslie?
All right. Well, that's great. Thank you so much.
Super. Thank you. 575-646-2212. We're going to be joining Anthony at our social media desk momentarily. If you are following us along on Facebook, thank you very much for doing so. And thank you to Sierra Vista Growers, supporting the community for over 30 years as a local source for native plants, fruit trees, vegetables, and more. Information at sierravistagrowers.net, Facebook, or Instagram. And Baqueta Jewelers, with more than 60 years' experience in the business, offering custom design work, repair services, and consignment jewelry. Online at baquetajewelers.com. Anthony, what do you have for us next?
Yeah, we have a question from John, who plants beans in his bed there. So he wants to know if he's looking to plant more plants in his bed, but he wants to know if there is a more robust or permanent plant that he could use to help replace the nitrogen in his soil.
Alfalfa.
Okay.
Alfalfa can be in your soil for up to 5 years, probably even more, and it will fix nitrogen into the soil. And there's some other legumes as well, but alfalfa is probably more permanent. You can actually eat alfalfa, too.
What?
Yeah, you can eat the new buds and stuff or grind it up and extract. It's real high in some minerals.
As growing up with horses, we had alfalfa around all the time. I had terrible hay fever. But I had never heard that before. Is there any good, a reason to eat it? Does it supply
you? It's full of minerals, for one thing. So I've taken alfalfa, I've run it through the blender, it's very green, and then strained it out and put it with lemonade, and you get this kind of acid green colored lemonade. It actually tastes really good.
How about that? All right. Anything else, Anthony?
That's what we have right now. I do kind of have a question in regards to, you had mentioned burning. Can you kind of give us a perspective on how that really impacts the soil and perhaps the trees or plants we have now compared to maybe 100 years ago?
It depends on what kind of burning. So if we're talking about burning for weeds, you're using a propane torch, and it's burning very low to the ground. You're basically just singeing over the top of the ground, so the soil doesn't actually get hot enough to do much of anything because it's not going to penetrate very deep into the soil. So if you want to get rid of weeds in a garden, you can... or pathogens, you can cover it with clear plastic in the summertime, anchor down all the edges, make sure there's some moisture under there, and you can use solar radiation to cook it a bit there to kill weeds, for one thing.
Okay. I was also curious, though, in different parts of the country, I mean, it was pretty prevalent years ago before we had these massive cities and suburbs everywhere and communities, you know, the burning that took place there compared to what we kind of see now.
People have burned Bermuda grass lawns, and we tend to discourage all that now, and I think the city has ordinances where you can't burn your lawns because of pollution. But it got rid of all the dead grass and different things, and, you know, it gets hot enough to kill weed seeds and that in there, but we're not doing that anymore. We don't even do it in the pecan orchards really anymore. There might be a few that do. Most of it's ground up in the pecan orchards and returned back to the soil.
Has that affected, you know, the gaming, like hunting and gaming, and what kind of animals are in different areas as well?
The burning?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're out in the forest, you know, the Gila and places like that, the forest used to burn on a regular basis, but it really burned only low to the ground, less than 4 to 6 inches, and it wasn't wildfire. It was just the natural way of it. Went through there and cleaned out the underbrush so that you didn't have wildfires.
Great. Thank
you. So we're trying to get back to those practices.
All right. Thank you, Anthony. We had a question before today's broadcast began from Susan. We talked a little bit about citrus trees earlier, and she said, I've been told that it's almost impossible to grow lemons here. A gardener did plant me a limon tree, which turned out to be a lime tree, and it has done well, surprisingly. But I would really like a true lemon tree, preferably Meyer. I've seen them at the home of friends in Tasmania, where the overnight winter temperatures definitely drop below freezing. Can I grow one here?
It depends on where you live. So if you, like within the city limits, we have a milder climate. And if you put it in a protected area, you can grow a Meyer lemon. Now, Meyer lemon isn't a true lemon either. So it's a cross between a lemon and an orange. True lemons, you probably could do it in a protected location. And you really need to have them on their own roots. So you can either start it from seed yourself, or I've been in Tucson where they sell like 1 gallon plants on their own roots. And that's because if you get a bad freeze, it'll freeze to the ground, but it'll still come back. Now, in my neighborhood, which is in the Alameda District, there are two lemon trees that have been there for probably 65, 70 years. And they did freeze to the ground in the 2011 when we had that real bad freeze, but they grew back and they're probably about 15, 20 feet tall now.
What would you say our first quarter has looked like in terms of moisture? It just seems like maybe we've had a little bit more than usual.
Yeah, our lives are fairly short. I've been here 37 years, which when I first moved here and somebody said they lived here 20 years, I thought was a long time now. Yeah, I'm here 37 years. But in my 37 years of being here, I have never seen this much moisture in March. I've seen snow as late as May, 4 or 5 inches, and it mm-hmm. melted the next day. But mm-hmm. I have not seen this much rain early on.
Do you think it portends to a more moist spring?
No. No, I think the heat's going to come and dry everything up within 2 days.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about then. I brought a song. Is there anything we should be doing at night in terms of, say, watering to be saving water or to make it last longer?
So we've had these rains. So I think a lot of people really aren't out there watering or doing anything, which is kind of good. But remember that rain is not penetrating that deep into the ground. So at some point, you're going to have to start watering. Watering at night, a lot of people that come from the east think watering at night is bad because it breeds mold and mildew and problems there. We're so dry here. Watering at night is generally not a problem. 97% of the time, it's not a problem. Depends on where you're at. So watering is good at night because you don't have the sun, the plants, you know, you're not evaporating as much. So mm-hmm. it's better for the plants. So sometimes I recommend, you know, if you could get up really early in the morning, like 5 o'clock or so, and water, or, you know, 10 o'clock at night is a great time, or before the sun sets.
Gentleman earlier who called about adding his sawdust to compost, it sounds mm-hmm. like he has just too much for like one
sounds
person's
like a lot,
yard,
yeah.
Right? What kind of bin do you recommend somebody use for compost?
So you can make your own. You don't have to go out and buy one of those plastic ones. So if you construct basically a square made out of cinder block, you know, you don't even have to cement them together. You just got to mm-hmm. hold it together. Don't put too much compost in at one time because you need to go out there and you need to turn it over. So you want to add grass clippings, anything green, get it in there to help break down the compost. you might have to put a little bit of inorganic nitrogen on there. Sprinkle some of that. You water it, put it in a watering can, sprinkle it over the top of that. Mix it up. Just keep mixing it up. The temperature will heat up to 140, 160 degrees. Keep turning it. It'll keep heating up. When it quits heating up, put it in another bin and start a new bin, you know, start a new pile, breaking it down. And that bin can age then.
How long does it take to get good compost from the time you start?
That depends on how much you're putting in the bin. So smaller amounts are going to decompose faster. You can't be too small, but they'll decompose faster in a reasonable amount of compost, and then you can use that. But generally, six, eight to 10 months, somewhere in there.
Okay.
You should be able to break something down.
And so do you recommend having these two different piles going all the time so that you have one that's
That would be great. You could have as many piles going as you want. But, you know, if you're only going to do a couple, you have your initial one. When it heats up and breaks down, put it in, and you can still mix it around, but you're going to be using that. You're going to let it age at that point for several months.
Is there anything that you wouldn't put compost on?
Maybe some native plants like cactus. Those things that are real drought tolerant that would not benefit from compost or mulching near them. You know, rock mulch is different than putting organic mulch because it would hold too much moisture and cause them to rot.
Let's talk a little bit about the safe handling of cactuses.
Okay.
It doesn't seem like there's anything you can do to prevent that cactus from getting you.
I worked for a cactus company for 6 years, and we had to handle cactus every day. And certain spines are worse than others, I'll say that. The little fine ones are probably, in my opinion, the worst. And those really thin, needly ones that seem to go through anything. But what we did was, you know, if you want to handle a cactus a bit, wrap your every finger you have, put one of those counting fingers, those rubber fingertips on there.
Okay.
And then wrap your finger or put on a glove, then put on an ordinary glove, a working type glove, and then wrap each finger up in duct tape.
Then just the coat of armor on top of that?
It seems to not go through the duct tape real well. It gets stuck in there if you have enough layers on there, and you can handle them fairly well.
But it seems like I can just walk by one and the spines jump off.
Well, there's the opuntias and the choyas. They have barbed spines, so if you even barely brush against them, they're going to stick in you.
All right. 575-646-2212, 2212. We thank you for listening. The Spring Gardening Confidential with Jeff Anderson here to answer your questions until 2 o'clock. So take advantage of this time. Call in a question, a comment. You can follow along on social media. We're streaming live on Facebook and at krwg.org. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. I'm Casey Counts, and Anthony Moreno is standing by at our social media desk to take your questions. We touched a little bit earlier on bees, and we want bees around. And what are some of the plants that would attract bees to your garden?
Well, right now the red buds are blooming, so they're very attracted to bees. I notice I have apple trees, I have pear trees, and I see more bees on the red bud trees. They're not necessarily native here, but they're really attract them this time of year. Alfalfa's attracts a lot of bees. It's a really good pollinator crop there for the bees for food and nectar. There's a whole lot of different things.
Does it make sense for us to be doing that? Would it help at all?
It helps. Generally, we don't have that many beekeepers around here. So most people are concentrating on the domesticated honeybee that we get honey from. So there are not as many beekeepers around. So when we think of not having a lot of bees, for one thing, in the way of honeybees, is because there's not a lot of beekeepers here. We need more beekeepers. And there's a beekeeper society here. The native bees are around too, but they're generally not in huge amounts like you'd find in a honeybee colony. So we need to protect all of them, and we supply food all throughout the year.
What about wasps?
Mesquite's good. Wasps are really good, too. We don't like them.
I don't know that there's
I would not
is there
want to be
anything
stung by
good.
Them.
Do they do anything good?
Yes.
Okay.
They're predatory wasps, and they go after a lot of insects. They'll prey on insects.
Because don't they kill bees, right?
I suppose they could. So do praying mantids and stuff like that, which are beneficial. They'll eat a bee, too. But, yeah, everything has a place in this world, even mosquitoes, which I don't like very much. I'm
right.
Not sure what their purpose is.
I think their purpose is human population control.
Yeah, probably. They bring malaria and everything.
I think that's it. So what other types of wildlife might people be trying to attract into their yards this time of year?
A lot of different birds. So a lot of the songbirds are coming back and you hear them singing. So people put out food and water. You got to be really careful about that because when
yes.
you put out bird food and it sits around, the one thing you're going to get is rats. And there are certain parts of the city, on the east side of the city, they have tremendous rat problems because people leave food out all winter and all year and it gets on the ground. At night, the rats come and eat it and then people get rattlesnakes coming in now in the spring.
And it's Mutual of Omaha right there in your backyard.
Yep, right there on your doorstep.
Do you have good recommendations of how to store the bird seed or just put it out and then take it out, take it back up at the...
Put it out, small amounts, limited time. It's going to get on the ground. It's kind of hard to pick up bird seed that way, but make sure you're storing your bird seed in a tight container that rats can't get into. And that's about all you can do. And if you get rats, you're going to have to trap them.
Oh, humane.
It's not fun.
Humane traps?
They are what they are.
They're cute. You know? I kind of like them.
Yeah, I hear people say they like them until they eat everything in their yard and the wires in their cars and everything else. And then they're not so nice.
Jeff Anderson with NMSU's Cooperative Extension Service and 575-646-2212. It's the Spring Gardening Confidential here on KRWG. And we have Michael on the line. Michael has a question about downy mildew. Michael, did I get that right?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Okay, hi. Yeah, my name's Michael McWhorter. This is a great show, by the way. Every spring, summer, we, like to plant watermelons, pumpkins, squash, and they sprout. They do great. They flower. Assuming we have honeybees, they pollinate. But as soon as we get the waves of humidity in July, the leaves get these gray-colored dust that starts along the veins of the leaf. Pretty soon it spreads to the entire leaf, and within 2 weeks, the entire vines are gone. And we don't know what to do about it. We've just quit gardening.
Yeah, I would say that's not downy mildew. That's powdery mildew. So that's a fungus. Yeah, there's a fungus. So, you know, it's really hard to find resistant varieties. And there are some treatments, and I don't think I can go into them right now. I there's chemicals that you can use. You got to apply them before the powdery mildew shows up. I've actually heard that using milk can, if you're looking organic, because it changes the pH. So you're changing the pH for the fungus to be able to grow in. There's a whole lot of products.
Neem when you oil. Say using milk, you just pour it in.
Spray it on.
Spray it on.
Yeah.
Spray it on.
Right.
Hey, I'm ready to use Agent Orange if it'll take problem.
Well, I also think that calcium nitrate in a low dosage helps with controlling powdery mildew, but that's a real tough one.
Would you you would suggest that maybe he contacts your office?
Contact your agent or myself. I'd have to really look into it and talk with our fungal expert as what would be the best control.
There's hope.
Yeah. But you got to start you got to start those things before it happens, because once it starts happening, it's pretty hard to straighten that all out again and bring it back.
I guess it's all in the soil now, but I'm trying to figure out where the heck it came from. Nobody else around here seems to have the problem. My theory is I may have brought it in on a bunch of bags of compost that I had purchased.
Well, it's in the air. It's in the air, and it may take, if you're growing a crop repeatedly, the first year you might not really get it. You might not even notice it, and it takes time for it to build up in high enough populations where now it is a problem. And then it's more permanent.
Yeah, seems to be. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael, thanks for the call. And there was an off-air question about milkweed. I'm just going to read it here, see if it makes sense. About milkweed and monarch butterflies and what kind of milkweed grows here and what are the average last and first dates of frost?
So in the past, our average first and last dates of frost. So the last date for frost in the spring generally has been considered April 1st, and that's moved kind of up depending where you're at to more like March 15th. The first frost in the fall has generally been around November 1st, but it can be as early as like the 23rd of October, depending on where you live in the valley, all the way up to, I've gone without frost sometimes, all the way up to Thanksgiving. So it depends on where you live. So the other part of the question was?
About milkweed and monarch butterflies. What types of milkweed grows here?
That's another one. I'd have to look up what our native milkweeds are here. There's a few around. We're not known for having monarchs here. We have a lot of queen butterflies. We have other butterflies. We're not on the main monarch flyway. That's west of here and east of here. We get a few that drift in now and then, but we're not on that flyway. You could plant a number of different things that help with the butterflies, zinnias, any kind of a flat flower where they can land on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Milkweed's good, you know, garden milkweeds. They don't always last very long in our soils here. And so they don't necessarily grow native out in our deserts because mm-hmm. it's too dry. So, but there might be some at the base of the mountains, some wild
types. But you would
types.
Actually want to plant milkweed for that purpose.
Yeah, it's up to you. There are other flowers, you know.
Other aloysia, options that...
Aloysia is another plant that's native here. Anything that will attract and feed. You got to start out with caterpillars before you have the butterflies flying through. So, you know, they're going to come to your garden. They're going to eat your parsley and your fennel and different things. So, you know, you can't get rid of those.
Right.
You don't want to be spraying those because then you get rid of the butterflies.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much for the questions coming in on the telephone line at 575-646-2212. A couple of our callers have requested not to be on the air, and that's fine, too. You can also follow along on social media. We'll be joining Anthony Moreno again if you have a question there in just a few minutes. So thank you for all of the ways that you're participating today. And for everyone who does, you'll be registered for that $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers. We have until 2 o'clock, so call now. Earlier is better. We don't want to get to the last five minutes of the show and have 72 people waiting in line. And waiting now is Ellen on the line. Hi, Ellen.
Well, hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
I used to live at San Augustine Pass, which is well above 5,000 feet. I could never get anyone in town to tell me what plants would grow up there.
I think your radio might be echoing back at you, Ellen.
Okay, I got it off.
And disturbing you a little bit along the way. Okay, go ahead. So what kind of plants to grow up there and continue?
Junipers that grow on the ground, they grow very well. I was able to grow. I couldn't grow very many trees. They would go down just a certain while, and as soon as those roots got to where they were going deeper, the trees would die. And it was, you know, roses were wonderful up there. But I really wanted different things to grow, and I could never get them to grow, and it appears that I may be going back up there to live.
Okay. So you'd still like some suggestions of what to plant when you get there?
Certainly.
So up there, what you're basically doing is growing on top of rock. So you've got probably a lot of blow sand and stuff and rubble on top of rock. So your big critical issue is water. And it's consistent watering because it's going to nowhere. You're going to water rocks, and it's just going to run off. And so your trees, you have to look for very drought-tolerant trees. And we were suggesting like Chinese pistache, Atlas pistache. But native trees like netleaf hackberry should do well for you up there. They are native right in that area. Some of the juniper trees that would do well. So if you're looking for shady trees like that, now... You'd have to amend your soil to grow better plants around. Make sure you have enough soil, not just pure rock. But I would suggest anything up in that area using as many of the native plants as possible. And down at UTIP at the Chihuahuan Desert Botanic Gardens, they have representatives of all the different plants. So you can actually go down there to the botanic gardens. You can look at the plants, kind of jot down what you like, and then check with the local nursery, see how available they are.
Oh,
and Sierra Vista
suggestion.
Growers carries a lot of those beautiful native plants.
Does that help, Ellen?
Yes, it most certainly does. I will try it as soon as I land.
Yeah, and
right.
The things you really like, grow in containers up by your house and water them that way.
Well, I had a wonderful patio, and it was enclosed and then I had two big places for trees in the back, and that's where the trees just would not, I couldn't grow a tree past, you know, it wouldn't grow very large, let's put it that way.
Right.
Okay, all right, Ellen. Good luck. Thank you for your call today.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. And next, rhymes with Ellen. Helen is up next. Hi, Helen. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. I can't wait for the greenery to come back full swing and planting to begin. That's always nice.
Are you going to be doing some of that this weekend?
I hope so. I have a question about the use of garlic around rose plants. How do you do that, and what does it do for the roses? Have you heard of anybody doing this?
Well, they've talked about if you plant garlic or use garlic around the roses, it helps keep certain pests away. Because the smell basically is confusing other pests. I have tried it. I haven't seen any success, really, that it worked doing anything.
It'll definitely keep the vampires away, though, from your garden.
Okay, well, that's good. All right. I had just heard about that, and I just wondered about it. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, Helen. Speaking of, keeping pests away from your garden, we talked a little bit about some of the things we want to plant to attract animals, but you mentioned, the onset of some pests that can come along with that, like rats. Is there anything that you can plant in your garden to keep those unwanted pests away, or some of the predator animals, for example?
No, they have plants like mosquito plant, and you still get mosquitoes, it's a geranium. But if you want to keep pests away, it's a matter of taking care of your plants, keeping them healthy, especially your trees, keeping them healthy, watered, and well-fertilized correctly, but not planting a monocrop. So we see in our farmers' fields, it's more of a challenge because you have like a whole field of cabbage. And that puts off a smell that all the insects can smell because it's a huge mass. Mm-hmm. It's a little different if you put one cabbage at your house. And that's where that putting garlic in there, it's confusing the scent because for the insect to find the plant, it's led by scent.
I see.
And so if you confuse it with other scents around it, it may have more difficult time finding the plant.
Okay, very good. Let's stay on the topic of trees and probably a good topic to get to before we run out of time, and that's pruning. And Brian is on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
I have a question about a vitex tree, also called chaste. Am I saying that correctly?
Correct.
But at the beginning of this time of year, we see a lot of spent flowers leaving sort of little bolitas behind. I always wonder if every sort of springtime, do I need to cut those off and prune those little bits off a tree, or can I just let them go ahead and do their thing without having to struggle with hundreds and hundreds of those little trimmy bits?
That's your personal preference, how it looks.
Okay.
Some people prune them off. I don't. I don't have that much time to be sitting there pruning those off. I leave them, and it flowers just fine the next year. Those are the little seeds that come out of there. And they are, some places are edible, too. If people have used them for spice.
Okay. So it won't neither harm nor improve the,
nope,
the health or the beauty of the tree itself?
Nope. The only problem is if you got a well-watered area where the seeds are falling, they might germinate and form colonies.
Sure. Well, I think you just saved me several hours.
It's like, don't worry about them.
But those goat heads, right, you got to go get to work on.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you,
Brian. Thank you very much for your call. 575-646-2212, the telephone number to call if you have a question for the last 15 minutes of the Spring Gardening Confidential with Jeff Anderson here on KRWG. And thank you, Jeff, for spending some time with us.
You're welcome.
Let's stay on the topic of pruning, though. I hope it's not too late. If you have a tree that needs to be trimmed back, is it too late to prune it back?
For most things, we can trim at any time of the year. There's certain things you want to trim only in the spring, like oleanders. I know they have brown leaves right now. I had a lady call me the other day. She had them all pruned in February, and she's wondering why they're all brown now again. Well, we had a bad freeze after that February pruning that she did, so they got further damaged. So they're a little tender here, so you want to wait late enough to prune them so that when the new growth comes out, it won't be frozen again. The other thing is a deciduous tree generally is better to prune it in the winter because you can see the branch structure and you know where you want to prune. Once it gets its leaves on it, it's kind of hard to see through all the leaves where you want to prune it, and then you have to haul that much more stuff away to the recycle center.
Yeah.
But you can prune most things any time of the year. If branch breaks, obviously you got to prune it, or you're doing some construction, you may have to prune it. You know, it's growing over the stop sign at the corner or over your fence, you know, so you can't get to the house, then you have to prune. But you can always call your agent and ask them about a specific plant and how to prune it.
All right. And another question coming in, off-air question, coddling moss treatments for worms in apple trees, organic and non-organic methods.
So let's start with the organic. So you can use Surround, which is a clay. So they spray, for organic purposes, you spray this kaolin clay on the apples in the tree, and it looks like the whole tree and everything is white. But that's meant to confuse, and it's also that the moth doesn't want to lay her eggs there because it's very confusing to the moth. Works real well, not 100%. So that's a treatment. You can do for apples if you have a lot of calling moth, you want to stay organic. You can get women's anklets. You can buy maggot control bags through several companies. They're made out of nylon. And you can slip them around each apple and tie the top shut with a twist tie.
How about that?
And leave it on all summer long, and you don't have to do anything else until fall comes, and then, you know, take them off. And that keeps out most of the coddling moth worms. If you don't do any of that, then it's a matter of spraying, and you, depending where you live, you may have to do up to 5 sprays per year.
All right. Now back to the social media desk, and Anthony Moreno has a question coming in. Anthony, hi.
Yeah, just following up on talking about pests, we have a question from Leslie who wants to know, what do you recommend to take care of leafhoppers?
Leafhoppers, you have to spray. Well, first off, get rid of the mustard. There's mustard everywhere this year, and that's where they're feeding on through the winter. And when the mustard starts to die, then they go to your tomatoes and your chili, and they carry chili wilt virus. So curly top virus, and all they have to do is bite into it one time, and they inject the virus, and then your tomato or your chili plant dies.
Wow.
So control the mustard in the wintertime. Otherwise, you're going to have to resort to some chemical sprays.
Also, we have a question from Lucy who wants to know about why there is so much mustard weed this year and how she can get rid of it.
We had more rain this year, so that germinates them. They're a winter annual. With the extra rain we've had, you know, it didn't dry out. They all germinated this year.
Now, can you eat that one?
You probably could. It probably doesn't taste very good. I don't believe it's poisonous, but I'm not sure you'd want to eat it.
It's not the mustard plant.
No, it's not the mustard you put on your hot dogs and hamburgers. No, not the same. Related to it, but not the same.
Right, right. All right. Thank you very much, Anthony. Anything else for the moment?
Yeah, we did have a question about a type of shrub. We had another question from Leslie who wanted to know about, she said she was discouraged by a local gardener from growing hydrangea. Yeah, hydrangea. And she wanted to know, she's seen that some of the new varieties coming out that look like little hydras are suited for zones 5 through 9. She wanted to know if you thought that they would not do well with our heat, or any recommendations you could make in regards to soil amendments.
So I actually have a couple of hydrangeas myself. So somebody gave me one of the florist ones like you find at Easter time, the blues, the pink ones and that. Mm-hmm. And they're a little more tender, but then I picked up an oak leaf hydrangea when I was out in Tennessee because we have 4-H contests where they have to identify one. So I have both of them. I keep them in containers with really good potting soil. The reason we don't grow them here isn't that they don't grow here. The fact is that they take quite a bit of water. So they need a constant supply of water. So putting them in the ground, they're not very drought tolerant. They're going to probably dry up and die pretty quickly if you don't keep water on them. So keep them in a very large pot. You can keep a hydrangea that way.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Anthony. It's 1:50, so we just have 10 minutes to go. And if you want to get your question into Jeff, do it now, 575-646-2212, or you can follow along on Facebook. Thank you very much for tuning in today to the Spring Gardening Confidential. I want to stay on the subject of flowers for the moment with Tiny Tim. I think it's been just long enough since I've heard this.
Tiptoe through the window, by the window, that's where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
You said your tulips are about to bloom.
Yeah, they're up. They've got their flower buds on them. So it's difficult to grow tulips here because we don't get cold enough in the winter. And our soils protect the bulbs, and if the bulbs don't get cold enough, they either don't bloom or they dwindle down. They'll bloom a little bit each year until they're finally gone. So if you really want to grow tulips and you don't want to be digging them up and chilling them, or you don't live in a cold enough area to chill them, then you want to grow specific varieties called Clusiana tulips. So there's Lady Jane and there's Cynthia. Those are the varieties. They grow like any other tulip. They're native to Turkey, but they need zero to almost no winter chilling. And they'll come back every year and be beautiful.
What do you recommend to put into your flower garden so that you have color throughout the spring and summer and even into the fall?
Yeah, I'm still working on that. So right now you've got, you know, I like spring there. So you've got red buds, you'll have forsythia, you got flowering quince, which will bloom for like a month. So you pick out those nice spring flowers. You know, flowering crab apples are really pretty, but the first one we got, all the flowers are going to blow right off of it. So that's not fun to lose that when they're so beautiful. Apples will give you apple fruit. You know, you have apricots, it'll bloom beautifully, and your plums will bloom beautifully as well. So those trees will be really nice. Then you have summer blooming trees like crepe myrtles and rain trees and vitex, some of those things there. And then you've got oleanders that'll bring you summer flower color. Tacoma, which is a native plant, yellow bells, Esperanza, blooms all summer. Once the heat comes on, there's a bird of paradise. So we got a lot of things. Then you look into the fall, things that have berries that develop, like your pyracantha. Mm-hmm. There's a beauty berry that has purple berries. There's some different hollies and different things. And the grasses in the fall, like regal mist with that beautiful pink, it looks like cotton candy in some of the grasses. So you can have color going throughout the year. And, of course, color in your tree leaves and the foliage and that. Look for that as well.
All right. Back to the phone lines for our last few callers, 575-646-2212. And Kristen, speaking of grasses, has a question about grass planting. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I have cleared an entire area of my yard. I've got all the I dug the mustard up piece by piece. It took me 4 days.
Congratulations.
Let me tell you, I have the back sore back for it. Anyway, I put in new soil. I rototilled it all around. I picked anything out of it that it, you know, was still bad. I've raked it. How warm does the grass or the dirt have to be in order to plant seed and have it take? And what's the recommended seed?
So are you going to plant fescue or are you going to plant Bermuda?
I'm not sure.
So fescue tends to be...
I don't necessarily have to have a green grass all year.
Okay. So then you could go with a Bermuda. So you could either go with seeding it or sodding it. If you go with sodding, it's maybe a little bit more expensive, but not a whole lot. But it's a hybrid, so it's seedless. So you're not going to get errant seed getting into your gardens.
Cool.
It's a little easier to control, and it's got a finer texture in that. So you could take pieces of that. You don't have to lay them end to end. If you don't have a lot of money, you can leave a foot gap, and it'll grow together as long as you water and fertilize it. If you're going to seed, there was Princess 77, which was a New Mexico State University release that had beautiful Bermuda grass from seed. There's some new cultivars out now. I can't remember what the new one is called. But they're real fine textured, but they need soil temperatures probably around 65 degrees to really grow well. Minimum 65.
So I'm looking at another month, right?
Yeah, sometime in April. Although Bermuda is just starting to grow, turn green right now in certain places where it's a little warmer, starting to come out. So April would be a little better. And then when you, if you were to seed it, you got to water it probably like 10 times a day. And it's not that you're putting on a lot of water, but you got to keep that top couple of inches continually moist. Because once the seed germinates, if you don't have enough water there, it'll just dry up and then you get to start over again.
No. You know, it's interesting because I lived in Houston for a time and you had to beat the Bermuda grass back with a shovel. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's the only place I've ever lived that I had an edge trimmer. Because it would grow right over the sidewalk and it was a mess.
I like St. Augustine grass here. I mean, it's a little tender to cold, but I really like it because it'll grow in the sun or the shade. So.
And that's, do you know if that's available at Sierra Vista and they'll bring a pallet?
I don't know if the grass company, there's a grass company in Sunland Park. I don't know, or Santa Teresa, that, that whether they grow it here. So, you know, I know people have traveled over to Phoenix to pick it up or over to Austin to get it.
Wow.
But I've seen big areas of it here, some beautiful areas.
Do you know anything about the cost, what cost you could be looking at?
No. A trip to Phoenix might, you know, overnight and everything else, it's going to cost.
Gas money.
Yep.
Gas money and hotel and then hauling it all the way back. Yeah. Okay. Now, I have one last question. If I go the sod route and it's delivered, say, on a Thursday, how fast do I have to have it laid?
You want to get it in as quickly as possible because that sod stacked up on the pallet, first off, it's going to dry out. Second off, it's going to be hot, and the interior of that is going to start composting. And you know what I was talking about, composting, when you get temperatures up high, 140, it starts killing everything. So, you know, if it's all stacked together and it gets hot, it'll kill that grass just as much as if you were composting it.
So that means if I'm going to buy sod, I got to get a bunch of the friends to come and help me lay sod.
Yeah, you know, and if you can keep it in the shade somewhere, you know, where it can't heat up too much, it'll help.
Okay. Well, that was very good information. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thank you. And I think we have time for just one more question, and that's going to come from John. Hi, John. Are you there?
Yes. Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a question about Afghan pines. I read in the local paper a horticulturist has a column there occasionally, and he said that most of the stress he's seen with Afghan pines is due to overwatering. Do you agree with that assessment?
I probably wouldn't agree with that. Most of everything I've seen has been underwatering, as long as you've got good drainage. But the biggest problem I've seen with Afghan pines and some of the other ones are bark beetles and borers. And we're just loaded with them all over the place, killing our Afghan pine trees.
Well, I try to keep an eye on the bark to see if there are any holes.
Yep, and sometimes you don't see them and the pine's declining, but I'd almost guarantee you probably have bark beetles or borers there. You don't always see them. Those holes are when they come out, not while they're eating.
I see. Would they come out in the nocturnal?
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, you can't stand there all day staring at the trunk waiting to figure out where it comes out. So in those cases, you have to use, there is no organic treatments other than a chainsaw maybe, but you need to use a systemic insecticide.
All right, well, thank you very much for your advice.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for the call, John, and it's 1:59. Thank you, Jeff Anderson, for being with us today on KRWG's Spring Gardening Confidential. I'm going to give you this bowl of entries so that you can pick out our winner for a $100 Sierra Vista Growers gift card. The Gardening Confidential, made possible by Sierra Vista Growers, supporting the community for over 30 years as a local source for native plants, fruit trees, vegetables, and more. Information at sierravistagrowers.net or on Facebook or Instagram. And from Vicata Jewelers, with more than 60 years experience in the business, offering custom design work, repair services, and consignment jewelry. Find them online at vicatajewelers.com. Let's hear that
and
name.
And the winner is Jeff Anderson.
I bet
don't
you,
I wish.
I mean, this is a passion for you, Jeff. It's clear. You brought plants with you today as our special guests.
So the winner is Leslie Simpkins.
Leslie, congratulations, and thanks very much for participating in today's Gardening Confidential. Casey Counts here, our Director of Content, Fred Martino, engineer Jacob Lockwood, handling your calls today. Anthony Moreno was on our social media desk, and Mark Johnson was our technical producer. The show will be available at krwg.org and, of course, on KRWG's Facebook page. So good luck with those gardens, and word to the wise.
Thank you very much. Water everything correctly, and I love Sierra Vista growers.
Yes, watering everything. Those were some of the tips you gave us before we began the show today.
Go out and enjoy life. You know, plant things and just enjoy them.
All right, NPR News coming up next here on KRWG, and then Leora Zeitlin and Intermezzo. Have a great one.